live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Setting the stage, game one of the World Series goes down in Fenway last night. And at this point, you almost have to wonder how the city of Boston would turn out for something like that. After all, this is not the same Boston that we knew. Not the same championship-starved Boston where the curse of the Bambino hung over everything in that town. Where it was all baked into the DNA. We can't quite finish. We can't quite get it done. Boston is not like that anymore. Boston is now title town. 15 parades and counting since Y2K. All commemorated by that smug little kid with that sign that is there to remind you that he has already seen 10 parades in his life and he's barely old enough to get behind the wheel of his old man's sled. That kid is there to remind you of that every chance he gets. Fact of the matter is, the town that couldn't win it, all it does now is win. All Boston does is win. Don't believe me? Ask anybody from Boston. This town has seen so much winning, you legitimately start to wonder whether it's actually getting old. But not last night. The city of Boston showed out last night. In fact, it started earlier in the week. It goes back to last week when Patriots wide receiver Julian Edelman went on the record with some straight-up L.A. hate, even before the Dodgers had clinched.
Just make it. Who are you going to
root for? I hate the Dodgers.
Pardon me?
I hate the Dodgers.
Well, I guess that settles that.
I mean, I'm a San Francisco guy. So, I mean, it's like Boston, New York diet over there. But I hope they do make it and the Sox pound them.
You notice what he said, too. It's not even like, I'm a Boston guy, I play for the Patriots. This guy went right there. Even before the matchup was set, Edelman is saying, I hate the Dodgers. I hate the Dodgers. And again, not because he's a Boston guy, but he's a Northern California guy.
I hate the Dodgers.
Which again speaks to the fact that NoCal hates SoCal way more than SoCal would hate NoCal. SoCal doesn't give a damn about NoCal. But you can take the guy out of NoCal, but not the NoCal out of the guy. Because Edelman hates the Dodgers and said it for the record. TB12 then chased that on Monday on WEEI, going on the record with a watered-down version of the same thing. Still pretty amazing considering that guy never says anything about anything with a mic in his face. But then last night, if there was any doubt how Boston would roll, none other than the Hood himself, Bill Belichick, hopped into a voiceover booth to narrate the freaking open of the national broadcast on Fox.
How do you make history? Championships. Not once, not twice. You win again and again. Everything you do, every day, is about winning. Through the years, the players have changed, but the commitment, the ambition, the goal has not. It's been like this for more than a century. These two teams now play for a ring, a championship, history.
You notice I haven't even gotten to the game yet. And notice that was not like some Bostonian honk like Ben Affleck or Mark Wahlberg or Matt Damon. That was the Hood himself. That was Mr. No Days Off himself spending a couple of hours in the studio hitting the ones and twos and laying down those silky vocals to remind everybody that Boston is about winning championships. How do you make history? You win championships. Not once, not twice. You win again and again. Everything you do, every day is about winning. So in other words, this World Series is not just Boston v. LA. It's Boston v. everybody. The Sox are pulling out all the stops. Even Boston's old man, James Taylor, got into the act, bringing his sixth string and getting straight up melodic with the national anthem.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land.
Thanks, Gramps. The Dodgers are standing there on the chalk wondering what the hell is Grandpa in the sweater doing, putting everybody to sleep. Not Boston. Boston was raging. By the time Carl Yastrzemski headed to the bump and bounced one to Dustin Pedroia before he took a mulligan, you knew all of Boston was flexing. What you may not have known and should have known, and what the Dodgers were soon to find out, the Red Sox would flex even harder. They made a statement last night, statement being, we don't need to be at our best. Or better yet, we don't need our ace to be at his best to beat you and beat you down. Because Chris Sale did not have his best stuff, and it didn't matter. The game got to the Sox bullpen, and it didn't matter. Dave Roberts emptied his bench and flexed his bullpen, and it did not matter. The Sox are just that good. That lineup is just that deep. Look, I don't know that the Dodgers' best beats Boston's best. But I do know, without it, they've got no shot against them at all. And last night, LA was nowhere near its best. Clayton Kershaw, clearly not the pitcher he used to be. And if he doesn't show up with the best of what he does have left, he's got no shot. Not against that lineup. And not if he's going to bring slop with him to the bump. And if he does that, then the defense better make plays behind him. Because the last thing you want to do is give the Boston Red Sox extra outs. You know, the very thing that David Freese did when he couldn't handle that foul pop-up from Mookie Betts in the first inning. You give Betts a new life, and it's going to come back to bite you in the ass. And it did. Of course he gets a hit. Of course he promptly steals second. Of course he comes around to score.
Benintendi hits it on the ground, past the diving Dozier, into right field, a base hit. Mookie turning third, he'll score, and the Red Sox lead 1-0.
And, of course, compounding matters is Yasiel Puig playing way too deep in right and then making a very Puig-like decision trying to nail the runner at the plate when he had no chance. Straight bonehead, even for Puig. Batter gets to second because of that and then quickly comes around to score, and the Dodgers are behind 2-0, just five batters in. Like I said on Twitter when it happened, could not have started any worse for LA or any better for Boston. Yet the Dodgers still hung around. It was still a game in the seventh when Dave Roberts and Alex Cora started moving their chess pieces around the board. Roberts pulls Pedro Baez, who was smoking fools, as he has the entire postseason. He goes to Alex Wood to get the matchup he's looking for. Cora counters by pinch hitting with Eduardo Nunez. Nunez does what he does, turning on a bad ball and putting the Dodgers into the ground.
Nunez swings it, drives one to left, high and deep by the wall. Gone! Three-run pinch homer, Eduardo Nunez. Can you believe it? And the Red Sox lead it 8-4.
Red Sox radio with that. Bam! Three-runner. The move blows right up in Dave Roberts' face. Ball game. Thanks for coming. See you tomorrow night. A three-run dagger from a dude that was hitting a .187 this postseason. And another crystal ball for rookie manager Alex Cora. I'm telling you, at this point, my man Alex Cora is wasting his talents on baseball. This guy's capable of so much more. We need this dude out there solving global hunger or global warming. Put Alex Cora into a room with the world leaders. Everybody's going to walk out happy 20 minutes later. This guy's doing this season, this postseason, is amazing. And last night was just like every other night for Cora. He's pushing the right button at the right time, and Boston just keeps on rolling. I know it's one game, but if you weren't quite sure what the Dodgers were up against, you are right now. Red Sox are scary. There's a reason why they went right through the defending world champs. There's a reason why they went right through the 100-win Yankees, because they're good. They can beat you any number of ways. They can beat you with pitching. They can beat you with hitting. They can mash. They can beat you with small ball. They can beat you with the big fly. And they've got a freaking wizard in the dugout orchestrating it all. One down, three to go for a Red Sox team trying to go down in history as the best Red Sox team ever. And back to my original point. If you thought the city of Boston was tired of winning and had gotten soft and spoiled and complacent, then you do not know that city. Sure, it's only one game. But then again, really it's not, because the Dodgers had their ace, and they were going up against Boston's ace, and Boston's ace was not what he once was. And they still couldn't get it done. If you want to treat your feet like some absolute kings, get yourself some Bombas. Bombas socks are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet.
Best ever.
2 years of R&D led to multiple improvements of the sock design, performance, and comfort. On top of that, a cushioned footbed reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness. And Stay Up technology, 133 tension levels were tested to find the perfect tension that's comfortable, stays in place while not being too loose, and never leaves a mark. Plus, super soft cotton that you will never want to take off. Best pair of socks ever, bar none. And one pair sold equals one pair donated. Did you know socks are the single most requested item in homeless shelters, but you can't donate used socks? That's why Bombas donates one brand new pair of socks for every single pair they sell. And right now, you get 20% off your first order if you go to bombas.com/Rome. That's BOMBAS.com. You'll get 20% off your first order. Bombas.com/Rome. Codename Rome. Best pair of socks ever. We are joined by GM Les Snead. Les, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. How about you, Jim?
Good, good. Les, good to visit with you. Lots to cover. So let me jump in. Sunday, Aaron Donald had 9 tackles, Les, 4 sacks, a forced fumble, and 1 fumble recovery. Over the years, you and I have talked about how much you appreciate him. But what was going through your mind when you saw him do what he did this past Sunday?
Well, I think when he gets on a roll like that, there's a snowball effect. I think what happens is, too, the offensive linemen of the opposing team start, you know, their confidence may be down once he gets in a roll and he gets fired up and he gets going and he has leverage. But I do think when you do get a lead, maybe a double digit lead, and it puts the 49, takes them out of their ability to truly run the ball like they want to, pass the ball, and you really put your OL in a bad situation when you're facing, you know, AD and RDL.
Les Snead joining us, and even then, he says there's still room for improvement. I mean, I'd argue the guy had a season in a day, and he's still talking about improvement, which is great. Les, as a team, you're 7-0, and you've put up 33 points or more in 6 of the 7 games. It feels like the defense is finding its rhythm as well. So as you step back and you look at the first 7 games, what kind of a grade would you give this team?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'll give it a letter grade or anything. What I do know, previous 7, it's obvious we played up to our standards at times, but in each of those games, even though we won them, there's times we haven't played up to, you know, our internal standards. That's something probably Aaron mentioned, as you just said. And I think the key for us, and I know the staff is doing it this week with the players, is going back into those moments and going, okay, you know, on this drive, we didn't play up to our standards. So in the game the other day, even though we put up 33 points, there were probably a few times where we settled for a field goal when we would have preferred a touchdown. And those are the things Aaron Donald's talking about.
We're talking to Les Snead. He's the GM of the Rams. Les, you mentioned the staff. I know you're an Auburn guy, so bear with me on this, but your left tackle, Andrew Whitworth, has said that there are only a few guys he's ever met who are like Sean McVay. Quote, Sean and Nick Saban, rare intensity. It's literally deja vu for me, end quote. What's your reaction when you hear that, and does that comparison sound about right to you?
It's very interesting, and even though I'm an Auburn guy, I respect Nick a lot and have gotten to know him over the years going in there. Obviously, they recruit well, they play well, so if you're acquiring talent for the NFL, you visit there a lot. And I think if you meet the two, they're probably, and you were out to dinner with them, you might not think they're similar at all in terms of personality, but I do think at the core of what they're trying to accomplish, you know, in their role as head football coach, very, very similar. Both of them are football savants. Both of them are really, really good teachers. Both of them have very, very high standards and do their best to prepare their players to meet those standards. So I think that's the similarity that Big Wit's talking about.
You know, you and I have talked about the first time you met Sean McVay, and you've shared your thoughts before. Is there anything maybe you know about him right now that you didn't know about him before last season?
If I were to say that I didn't know, I can tell you this, even though we're 7-0, even though we've played well, I bet you if I went down the hall right now and it's Wednesday morning, we're getting ready, and he's going to have a team meeting probably in about an hour. But as he prepares for this, you know, this game against Green Bay, he's not satisfied. There's not any part of his DNA that is satisfied. And I think that's just natural. I've met a few people in my life like that. It's you know, they're almost miserable trying to reach greatness. And I think, you know, you can put on an act trying to be that, but it comes naturally to him.
We're talking to Les Snead. Now, I mentioned off the top that you've made 11 trades through March 14th or from March 14th through the 2018 draft. That's a lot of moves. It means bringing in a lot of different faces. A lot of times, of course, when that happens, a team might get off to a slow start, yet you guys are 7-0. So how do you explain the fact that everybody got on the same page as quickly as they did?
Well, you know, a lot of people, when you have the success that we've had over the last 2 years, you know, at the college level, you know, because us in the NFL usually don't share too many ideas with competitors, but, you know, they'll talk about the culture. What kind of, how you got, it looks like you got a great culture out there. And I think it's a little bit cliche, but we try to keep the main thing the main thing. It's all about football, a little bit like the Nick Saban comparison. Sean's a football savant. He wants to teach his players football. He wants to learn from his players. So I think when you have a singular purpose, you can bring in a group of individuals from many different backgrounds with a lot of different personalities. But that main goal, when you walk in this building, you know, at any moment during the season, it's all about getting better that day. And I think that main goal keeps everything together and blends a lot of the group together.
We're talking Les Snead. You know, Les, in terms of the main thing being the main thing, you've got another way of putting that I've heard you talk about. You talk about the fact that you want to push away all the small rocks that are distractions and focus and dominate on the big rocks. As a GM, for instance, what are the small rocks and what are the big rocks?
I think I've always said, as a GM, your main big rock, and I think you're accountable for the roster that you have, and not only the talent on it, but the ability for that roster to come together as a team. And if you, that's number one. If you get that right, I often say, you'll have a chance to work on the small rocks, whatever they may be. And small rocks can be, and there's, you know, there's different levels of small rocks. But I think what I always say, the thing a GM has to concentrate on most is, okay, acquiring talent, developing that talent, or assisting, putting in, let's call it processes and staffs to be able to develop that talent, and then also, you know, build that team, add those, you know, parts of the organization to help build that culture and all of that. So anything other than that is probably wasting my time. But you. At that point in time, one of the big rocks is making sure you do put together an unbelievable staff to be able to handle all of those rocks that aren't that, and also to help you with that rock. And I think that's the GM in a nutshell.
The Rams are 7-0. They've got the Packers this weekend. We've got another moment or so with Les Snead. So you played three straight games away from home, but I want to go back to that Thursday night game against the Vikings, prime time against a good Minnesota team. Jared Goff turns in a masterful performance. The crowd is having a blast. How significant a moment was that for the team and the organization in terms of bringing football back to L.A.?
I think that's a big moment. Because it is Thursday night football. It's the first, Fox, they jumped into the Thursday night arena. That was their first, you know, game where it was Fox, not NFL Network. LA's a town that likes the big stage, things like that. You're playing a really good opponent that was in the NFC Championship last year and on paper supposedly improved at QB. So all those things come into play there when you go to battle and you go out and you play well and you're successful on that stage. And I think that what that does is if there's a snowball effect, if there's momentum building, fan support in L.A., that just makes that snowball a little bit bigger.
I'll make it about you for 1 minute. If you were with the personnel department in Jacksonville, the season was not going so well. In fact, the team was 3-6. Things were looking kind of bleak. What do you remember the season and your thoughts about your future in football?
Well, it's great story. Now probably would go right into your commercial break.
But do it.
We're 3-6. We're down in, at that point in time, Steve Spurrier's in Gainesville. There's rumors that Spurrier's coming to Jacksonville. I think I've even made the joke. I got out the old, let's call it, applications to law school. I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I'm made for this football thing. I think I'm going to go do something easier. Even looked at the Pepperdine Law, and I'm like, who couldn't go to class there? and all that. But what I do know about Tom Coughlin is, you talk about the main thing, consistency. If I learned anything from Tom Coughlin, well, you're 3-6, 6-3, and I think he showed that with his years with the Giants. Guess what? Let's do what we do. We're the same. There's no emotional roller coaster. And next thing you know, we finished the season 9-7, and even did more damage in the playoffs.
Listen, a lot of agree at Pepperdine. Had to sound pretty good at that time, but it's a good thing you did not give in to that. The Rams are 7-0. They're in first in the NFC West, and they are hosting Green Bay on Sunday. Their GM, Les Snead, my guest. Les, great to have you back. Thanks so much for doing that, and good luck this weekend.
Definitely. Appreciate you having me.
Fix it, work to do around the house? Then check out my pals at Ferguson. No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors with thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game. When the pressure is on, count on Ferguson. Now, if you thought that Rondo CP3 fight started on Saturday night, you were wrong. And if you thought that fight ended on Saturday night, you were wrong again. First off, the two of these guys have history. And it goes without saying, they are not bros. These two are not boys. They have history. And even though Saturday's throwdown ended with both these guys being suspended and Rondo accused of spitting, it's not ending there either. At least not as far as Rondo is concerned. For one thing, Rondo is still insisting he did not spit on Chris Paul. Quote, "I had a mouthpiece in my mouth. I was exasperated because I was about to tell him to get the bleep out of here." End quote. Right, pretty strong opening statement. As far as the argument goes, "I was exasperated because I was about to tell him to get the bleep out of here." It's pretty nice. Pretty nice. But Rondo was only getting started. He then moved on to video evidence. The Rockets think they have video evidence. Rondo presented his own video evidence. Quote, "Look at my body language. My hands are on my hips. I turn away for a second. I look at Eric Gordon and Melo in the video. If they saw me spit, they would have turned their face up or something. They had no reaction." End quote. So once he was done with his video evidence presentation, he then moved on to whether or not he spit on Chris Paul. He moved from the video evidence to the theoretical. Rondo said, quote, "One, if I spit on you, bottom line, there is not going to be no finger pointing. If you felt that I just spit on you, then all bets are off. Two, look at my body language. If I spit on you on purpose, I'm going to be ready for a man to swing on me. You ain't going to have my hands on my hip and my head look away at someone if I spit on them." End quote. So listen to his argument. His argument is, if I spit in that guy's face, he wouldn't poke me in the face. He'd be ready to go. And if I spit on a guy, I know he's ready to swing on me, so I'd be ready to go. He didn't swing on me, and I was not ready to go. Therefore, I did not spit on the man. That's his argument. Look, I don't really know. I don't know if he did or if he didn't spit on him, or if he did or didn't spit on him intentionally. The slow-mo, high-def video sure makes it look like some sort of liquid came coming out of Rondo's mouth into Paul. But Rondo's adamant that he didn't do it. And he's adamant about something else. Something even spicier than spitting, if you can believe that. And here comes the pivot from the fight to Chris Paul as a person. Quote, "After the bleep goes down, within 30 seconds, you run and tell sideline reporters that I spit on you? If I spit on you, you are trying to get to me. You're not trying to make up a story so you can look like a good guy. It makes no sense to me." End quote. Look at Rondo. Rondo's other take is, look, if I really spit on this guy, he'd be looking to knock me the hell out. Instead, he's running to sideline reporters to tell them that I spit on him to make himself look like a good guy and me a bad guy. So now Rondo's getting loose. Rondo is working the body repeatedly, and now that he got his man to drop his hands, he's going to go headhunting. He's looking to ice this cat. He's looking to put this guy to sleep. Check this quote. Quote, Everyone wants to believe Chris Paul is a good guy. They don't know he's a horrible teammate. They don't know how he treats people. Look at what he did last year when he was in LA trying to get to the Clippers locker room. They don't want to believe he's capable of taunting and igniting an incident. End quote. You know that phrase? That phrase, he just went there? It's been beaten to death. I hate that phrase. I hate he went there. But Rondo, he just went there with Chris Paul. Quote, everybody wants to believe Chris Paul's a good guy. They don't know he's a horrible teammate. Calling a guy a horrible teammate is such a great line. And especially that guy, because that guy is allegedly one of the best guys ever. Calling Chris Paul a guy who takes a lot of pride in his reputation for being a great guy and a great teammate. Calling that guy a horrible teammate is pretty amazing. And of course, it was Rondo who said it. Rondo lives for that type of thing. Rondo thrives on moments like that. I mean, how many times have you heard that about Paul behind the scenes? Lots of times. But how many times have you heard another NBA player put that right on the record like that? Have a guy come right out and say what I always say about most of these guys. I always say that myself. We don't know most of these guys. Well, that's exactly what Rondo just did. Rondo, in effect, said, y'all think Paul is a good guy, but y'all don't know him. But I do, and I know he's a horrible teammate. So Rondo says he didn't spit on Saturday night, but this guy was spitting fire yesterday. That's lava. That's venom. That's amazing. And not only that, he wasn't backing down from it either. The only thing missing from that was, did I stutter? And of course, it set off a reaction on social media. Daryl Morey, Rockets GM, one of the great Twitter users in the game, went with an image of a pot and a kettle. Let me just stop right there. Great use of Twitter by Daryl Morey, and he had his guys back. But that whole pot and kettle thing kind of doesn't work. I mean, we know Rondo is a little bit different. We know Rondo is a guy who gets under people's skin. I mean, Rondo is Rondo. We know what he is. So I don't know if that pot and kettle thing works. I mean, yeah, maybe he's calling him a hypocrite. You could say that. But that whole thing about Chris Paul isn't necessarily known or articulated. But if he's calling him a hypocrite, so be it. But that doesn't mean that what Rondo said isn't true. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that's not the first time we've heard that, right? But it is the first time a guy like that's gone on record with it. So who's right? Who's the good teammate and the bad teammate? Who's the good guy and the bad guy? Why don't we check with somebody who played with both of them and then get the real reaction? Oh, I've got one. Big Baby. Big Baby, Glenn Davis. He played with both of them. And unlike Daryl Morey, he didn't go with the subtle artistic route. He went with the Instagram post that read, and I quote, I played with both of them. CP3 is a very bad teammate. End quote. Damn. But then he deleted the post. Come on, G. Come on, Glenn. If you're going to post it, keep it. Because it's not like you can erase it. It's not like it wasn't seen. It's not like everybody doesn't know. You can't delete a post. If that thing's up there for more than 1 second, somebody will see it. And if somebody sees it, they will grab the screenshot. And if somebody has a screenshot, they're going to push it out there. Come on now. Deleting it does not change anything. Stand by your opinion, especially because it's an interesting opinion. So the fight was Saturday night. It's now Wednesday. Punches are still being thrown. I love it. Honestly, I love it. I couldn't love this anymore. And let me remind you, the NBA season is only 1 week old. We're only a couple of games in, and we've already had a fight, an aging rock star kicked out of the arena, and a horrible teammate blast directed at one of the, quote, best players and best guys in the league. And y'all are tripping because the Lakers are 0-3. I can't remember the last time I was this fired up on the Lakers or the association this early in the season. I mean, that's an amazing story. And Rondo going Rondo is incredible. Rondo going, y'all think he's a good guy? He's a horrible teammate. That's why he was trying to get into the locker room of his former team last year. Why? Because, quote, he's a horrible teammate. I can't speak to him being a horrible teammate because I've never played with Chris Paul. but Rondo can speak to it. Heavyweight Derek Lewis is my guest. Derek, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you on, Derek. Listen, before I ask you about 230 and the title fight against Cormier, can you go back to UFC 229 and that incredible fight against Alexander Volkov? The thought was that you were trailing on the cards in the third round. So what was your mindset in the final minutes of that fight?
Before the fight, it was like I told my coaches that it would be cool if I could have one of those Rocky Balboa fights since I'm fighting the guy that looked like John Drago.
Right.
And so enough that we ended up having one of those type of fights. So I was happy with that.
That's great. Now, you had one of those fights. Now, if you were trailing late and you get to the final moments of the third round, at that point, what's going through your mind? What are you thinking? What was the plan?
It's like kill or be killed at this moment. Don't care if he's going to hit me with a jab or anything. I just knew that I had to touch him just once.
Derek Lewis joining us, and you did. You caught him with a great shot. It looked like you were poked in the eye a couple of times in the fight, but you kept on battling, and then dropped him with that one shot, and then you followed that up with a flurry of punches that ended the fight with only 11 seconds left. What do you remember about that punch, and then how good did it feel to end it the way you did?
It just, whenever he hit me in my eye, it just felt like I had soap in my eyes. In both eyes, just felt like I had soap in it, just burning, and I couldn't keep my eyes open. So the little moment that I gave myself by backing away and putting my head down, cleared my vision up just a little bit, but it was still blurry.
Derek Lewis joining me. Now, Derek, you've mentioned that you may not be the perfect fighter, but you've got a ton of heart. What's that win say about your heart?
That I'm never going to give up on myself because I've been down and out before, and I know what that feels like, and I don't want to be in that spot again.
We're talking to Derek Lewis. He's got a title shot coming up, UFC 230. Derek, if the punch that ended the fight was awesome, the post-fight interview may have been even better, and it made headlines all around the world. For anybody who's forgotten, let me just play this money line right here for everybody to hear.
I'm here with the winner, Derek Lewis. Derek, why'd you take your pants off?
My balls was hot.
I understand.
Derek, that line now is on T-shirts, it's on sweatshirts, people can buy it. Did you have any idea how huge that was going to be when you said it?
Not at all. So I always say whatever after my fights because it's always the same question. So I like to mix it up a little bit all the time.
Derek, as somebody who's paid to ask questions, I respect a guy who likes to mix it up all the time. It's a good thing. You know, in that post-fight interview, Joe Rogan also asked you about fighting for the championship, and at that point you said you need to sit down and you weren't trying to fight for the title right now, yet all of a sudden you and I are talking about you fighting for the title right now. So what changed?
The money changed. They offered me more money than they usually offer guys to fight for the title. So I was happy with that. So, yeah, I would start doing all kind of cardio after that.
I love that. Hey, money talks. You said it yourself. In fact, what you said was, they threw money at me like I was a stripper, and I was fine with it. It's another great line. When the decision to fight Cormier, for that kind of money, is that an easy decision, or was that a tough decision?
I didn't care who was the opponent. It was an easy decision. I'm always like that. I prefer to fight harder fights anyways. I don't call anyone out that I don't believe that it would be an easy fight.
We talked to Derek.
I called out Nogano, and I called out everyone out before.
Derek, is there such a thing at this level as an easy fight?
Oh, not at all. None of these guys are easy. They might look like they're not technical or don't have that much skills like the next, but a regular guy on the street just can't come in here and just make things look easy for him.
Derek Lewis, my guest. Derek, do guys like that, do you ever get any of that? I mean, I don't know where you hang out, but do like regular guys on the street, you know, if you go to a bar, there's always that one guy. I mean, every bar has one. There's always that one guy who's got to try out the guy. Do guys off the street think they can hang with you guys? Have you ever run into that at all?
Oh, for sure. All the time. That's why I don't really go out anymore. As soon as they get enough liquor in them, they believe they could take out any guy just because they see it on TV thinking that, I could take this guy.
Liquid courage. Every bar's got one. You know, your journey is amazing in the sense that only a year ago, you had reportedly given some thought to retiring from MMA after a loss to Mark Hunt. Is that true? What were you thinking at that time, and what kept you fighting?
I was dealing with a real bad back injury, and that the pain was so bad during the Mark Hunt fight that I couldn't even stand anymore. And I've been dealing with it for years, and so I just wanted to just not put myself through that pain anymore at the time. But also, I was like, I really haven't been training like an MMA fighter. Most guys usually train all day long and be in the gym all day and eating right and taking care of their body right, and I wasn't doing any of those things. And so I just wanted to give myself a full shot before I call it a quit.
So,
and I have been just this last fight only, though.
So did you guys kind of pick up those habits, that lifestyle? Have you approached it that way? And what's been the difference since you did?
I've been walking around even lighter than I usually walk around at. Usually I walk around at like 290, but I've been walking around at 275.
Derek Lewis, my guest, he's got the title shot coming up. So Derek, what's it like? All of a sudden now, I mean, you went from thinking about retirement to being a fan favorite, to fighting for the heavyweight championship coming up soon enough. You've got this great honesty. People love you for it. I mean, what's it like now? Do you like being out and about and everybody knows who you are and they want to embrace you? Or frankly, would you kind of rather be left alone?
Oh, I like to be left alone. You know, I don't do this for publicity or for the fans or anything like that. I just do it for the money, for the job. I mean, it'd be great if people forget about me next week. So I don't care about that.
Respect. Man, I could not respect you anymore for that. It's business, right? It's business.
Yes.
Do you have a passion for the sport and the process, or really is it just business?
Yeah, I don't have a passion for the sport at all. It's just business. I'm not a mixed martial artist.
So do you do it because you've got a knack, because you're good at it, and that's the thing you can make the most money at? Why do you do it?
I do it because, yeah, it makes the most money, and I just like to fight. And, you know, I have a criminal background, and I believe this is one of the last things that I'm really good at that I could really take care of my family with.
Well, man, you are the best. Derek Lewis, my guest. So when it's all said and done, hey, look, you can't get ahead of yourself one day at a time. I understand you got the biggest fight of your life coming up. But when it's all said and done, what's the plan? Do you hope you have enough money in the bank and you can do whatever the hell you want? Or is there something to do outside the cage, too? What do you do next?
Invest. You know, I'm always looking, trying to invest in something. You know, open up my own business. You know, me and my wife right now, we have a salon. We're trying to really get up and going. And just trying to invest, you know. That's about it.
We're talking to Derek Lewis for a few more moments. He's got a fight coming up. It's pay-per-view only. Pay-per-view only. It's at Madison Square Garden. You know, Derek, I'm hearing what you're saying. So it's business and it's a process. I was going to get all caught up in what's it going to be like to walk into the cage at Madison Square Garden where some of the biggest fights in the history of the world have been. I kind of get the sense you're not going to get caught up in that either.
No, not at all, because I believe every fight that I had, I believe that it was the biggest fight, because, you know, I really don't even supposed to be here, you know, because most of the guys that I'm fighting are way more technical than I am. You know, they're all martial artists. I'm not a martial artist. I'm a brawler. And so I don't have the same skills as my opponents do.
Yeah, but you got something, though, right? Everybody's looking for their edge. So if you don't have the same skills that they have because they're mixed martial artists, what do you bring to it? What makes you better or different than them?
I just think I have the most heart in the sport, and I believe you got to have heart to really succeed in the sport.
All right, so when you look at Cormier, what kind of thoughts do you have about Cormier, and what's your best path for victory against Cormier?
Really just weather the storm. So I know he's going to come out and try to get me tired, push the pace, and take me down. Or even if he's not going to try to wrestle me or take me down, anything like that, just staying with him. So I know he hits hard just like I do. And just wait for my moment. You know, be patient. Don't let the surroundings overwhelm me, even though I'm fighting for the title.
Yeah, I mean, it does not sound like that's going to be the issue right there, not the environment or the surroundings. I mean, you're ready for the opportunity.
Yes.
And most important, Derek, before you go, you guys do have beef, a legitimate beef, a beef about Popeye's chicken. Have you guys put that behind you yet? Where does that stand?
Right now we put the chicken behind us. But after the fight, that's one of the first meals I'll be eating, Popeye's chicken.
You got it. Derek, last thing. Cormier, to me, man, he, like you, Cormier is a really good dude. I mean, he's a really good dude, not for that sport, but for any sport. Can you acknowledge that? Or if the guy has something that you want and is trying to take something that you have, can you not see that guy like that?
Oh, no, he is a real good guy. You know, I have nothing bad to say about him. You know, it's just business right now.
Just business. The UFC Heavyweight Championship's coming up. UFC 230, Madison Square Garden, November 3rd, pay-per-view, Cormier v. Lewis. Derek, I appreciate you. Great to have you on the show, man. I really, really enjoyed that. Good luck in that fight, and hope we can talk again.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
No secret, the Broncos have had some issues at quarterback. And not just this year, by the way, but for a number of years now. Ever since Peyton Manning took his giant helmet and walked off his giant pink dome, there has been a carousel at quarterback for the Broncos. A carousel of bad quarterbacks. All of a sudden, John Elway can't figure it out. Brock Osweiler. Trevor Siemian. Paxton Lynch. Brock Osweiler again. And even Case Keenum. Not so much. Now put aside for a minute that the guy picking all these quarterbacks was one of the best to ever play quarterback, John Elway. How the hell can you be that good at the position and that incapable of judging whether or not somebody else can play the position? It's really weird. I mean, this guy looked like an absolute genius when he broke off Tim Tebow. And then he looked even more intelligent for convincing Peyton Manning to throw that wounded duck for the Broncos. And then they won it all. But it's been an unmitigated disaster for Elway and the Broncos under center since then. So bad, there was actually some noise that the Broncos might turn to Chad Kelly. You remember Chad Kelly, right? The final pick in the 2017 draft. He apparently had shown enough in practice that maybe he was going to get a look. Not only a look, but sooner than later. Because this crew needs something to jumpstart that offense. They've got way too much talent to struggle the way they are right now. And I guess in a way, it's a testament to Kelly. You show up in camp, you bust your ass, you work your way from Mr. Irrelevant to a suddenly very relevant guy. It's pretty impressive, actually. So you're on the verge of getting a look at a starting job. You're on the verge of getting a look at something that only 31 other guys have on the entire planet. So you put yourself in that position. What do you do on a Monday night, Tuesday morning in Colorado? Do you put your nose in the playbook? Do you get in some extra reps? Do you watch some film? Do you nap it out? Get to bed early? Nope. You criminal trespass. Chad Kelly, arrested Tuesday morning on suspicion of first-degree criminal trespass after a couple reported that he entered their home uninvited around 1 o'clock in the morning and sat down on their couch, quote, mumbling incoherently, end quote. What? According to the police report, the female in the couple was holding their young child and sitting on the couch just inside the front door when, quote, an unknown male entered the residence uninvited and sat down on the couch next to her mumbling incoherently, end quote. So what's going through your mind right then? What's going through your mind when your young child is on the couch with you and some stranger, and not a small stranger, an NFL-sized stranger, comes in and sits down next to you? You'd be tripping. I know I would be. What's scarier than that? Some dude ending up in your house in the middle of the night, uninvited. It's going to end badly. This dude's not looking for a cup of sugar. Not if he's uninvited and letting himself in the middle of the night. You're minding your own business. You're in your own home. You're tending to your child. And in comes some stranger and sits down right next to you. I don't know what's going through her mind, but I guarantee her response was not, damn, Chad? Chad Kelly? Dude, is that you? Bro, aren't you going to start this Sunday? I mean, Chad, have you already forgotten that you got your ass kicked out of Clemson? Have you already forgotten that you were not invited to the combine because of stuff like this? I mean, come on, Chad. Get your act together. No, of course not. No, that's not the conversation she was going to have with him. She did what any wife and mom would do if some bag showed up in the middle of the night, uninvited. She called out to her man, who, according to police, quote, confronted the male in the living room and hit him with a stick in the upper back as he kicked the male out of the residence. The stick was later identified as an aluminum vacuum tube. That's what I'm saying. Some rando comes into your house, middle of the night, uninvited, mumbling incoherently. You do not know what his intentions are, so you're not going to wait to find out. You're going to go upside dude's head with a vacuum cleaner tube. Weaponizing your vacuum on short notice. I like that. I like that a lot. In fact, I'll be putting a vacuum tube under my bed tonight. That's getting nice, because that could have gone so much worse. As for you, Chad, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing getting so jacked up that you're just walking into random homes, sitting on their furniture, uninvited, before getting a vacuum cleaner beat down and getting chased off? Look, dude, I know you're no rocket scientist, but you cannot explain that away as just some mistake or the fact that you were confused. I mean, I don't know what you were on, allegedly, but to end up in that house at that time of night, it must have been pretty lethal, whatever it is you were on, allegedly. I mean, forget for a moment that you have a look at being a starting quarterback in the NFL and you blew that shot. I don't care what job you have. You can't just be showing up at people's homes wearing a vest and a scarf and sitting on their furniture. But then there's the fact that you did that just as you were about to get a starting job, or at least a look at a starting job, when you were the last guy taken in the draft, when you had so many opportunities that you had already blown through. I mean, you want to talk about the worst kind of self-sabotage. My man, you need to talk to somebody or spend some time somewhere. Something. Somebody. Do something. But who am I to give this guy advice? Let me turn this over to one Leonard Dykstra, who has a message for you via Twitter. Lenny Dykstra, thumb this out. @ChadKelly_6. Quote, you're a pro QB. Let me give you a word of advice. As a pro QB on a popular team, you don't need to go into stalking mode. Even if you don't go as far as I did and have, quote, your people, have the party going and the girls already waiting at your hotel suite for post-game fiesta. Hey, Len, thanks. Thanks for that, and thanks for taking a break from doing whatever the hell it is you're doing to mentor the youth of today. That's a powerful message. A powerful message about, well, I have no idea what the hell that message was about, but it was powerful. It was a powerful message and one that should be heard and heeded by everybody, whatever the hell it was about. Normally, I would not do that to you, Chad. I would not subject you to life advice from one Lenny Dykstra, but my man, that's where you are right now. That's where the hell you are right now. So in my unpaid, completely unprofessional opinion, you do need help. This is not the first time you've been in trouble. This is not the first time that you've blown a really good opportunity. Get help before something even worse happens. Something worse than being hit by a vacuum while wearing a vest and a scarf. Oh, and this late-breaking news bulletin from earlier this morning, the Broncos have, in fact, waived Chad Kelly. The Broncos, a team desperate for a quarterback and a team itching to give you a shot when you were the last player taken, have waived you. I hope that was worth it. You've gone from a possible NFL starter to beaten with a vacuum cleaner tube, arrested and waived in a matter of hours. And now you're getting lectured by Lenny Dykstra. My man, forget about the starting job. Forget about the roster spot. Forget about everything else that's going on in your life. You're at the point where Lenny Dykstra looks at you and says, man, you are a screw-up. And if that's not rock bottom, what the hell is? John Morosi back in the jungle. Good to have you back, John. How are you?
Doing outstanding, Jim, and thanks as always for the wonderful introduction. I appreciate it very much. I need to actually get back, and now that I have kids that are getting older, it's probably about time for us to dust off the old Ghostwriter DVDs if I can find them and expose the kids to one of the great shows of all time.
You know it. You should do it. All right, John, first things first, Clayton Kershaw, Chris Sale. That was shaping up to be one of the all-time great World Series pitching matchups. So what did you make of what you saw from each of them last night?
Well, Jim, we probably should have seen this coming, right? When you hype up a pitching matchup like this, I looked it up yesterday, and two of the all-time 10 best pitchers in the game's history by regular season ERA, and naturally, neither of them recorded an out in the fifth inning. Of course, that was as everybody predicted. No, it really speaks to the way that postseason baseball games are managed and played now. Heavy bullpen involvement, of course, for both teams. Kershaw in particular, I think his location was off. As Dave Roberts said after the game, that the slider command wasn't really there, and really the fastball command wasn't either. Sale, I think, I probably give more credit to the Dodgers on his effort. I think they just did a very good job of waiting him out and taking a lot of tough pitches, fouling off tough pitches. I think you saw a really good approach for the first half of the game from both teams, and then with the Red Sox, just a big moment there for Nunez to come in as a pinch hitter and hit a ball that I think, you know, as much as Dave Roberts is getting second-guessed here, that was, I think, the right move to make. I think you look at the splits there for each guy, and you knew that Alex Cora was not going to let you have the platoon advantage, that there was either going to be a pinch hitter or you would have Devers facing a righty. And with Nunez, that ball was almost to his back shin, effectively, and he hit it out of the ballpark. So that was a great bit of hitting by Nunez, a big moment for him in the World Series. Career hitter under 200 in the playoffs. So, Jim, it was an unlikely hero, and I think that as much as we always want to talk about the pitching matchups among the starters, it is often, as was the case last night, a matter of the bullpens, and last night Boston's was a little bit better.
John Morosi joining us. And Nunez, John, as you know, as we all know, that's what he does. He takes bad balls and gets them out in a hurry. Now, if you're Dave Roberts, and I appreciate what you said about him, that you felt like he made the right decision, it just didn't work. What's the biggest adjustment you're making if you're Dave Roberts, looking to see what you can get out of your players in game two?
Well, I think, Jim, one thing that's really unique about the start to this World Series is you've got two left-handers starting the first two games for both teams.
Right.
So you almost would expect after two lefties in game one that you'd have a lot of lineup changes in game two and shuffling things up just because of natural lefty-righty. Well, that's not the case. Ryu and Price go in game two here tonight. So I think for me, Jim, it's going to be a lot of the same. This is a team, the Dodgers, that has consistently applied what they view as their platoon advantage. A lot of right-left decision-making going on for the Dodgers. Puig is a little bit different because he actually has not hit lefties all that well this year. So maybe they make a change there and find a way to get Kike Hernandez involved in the game earlier. But I think, to me, you roll with a lot of the same guys. I think Freeze had some very good at-bats last night. Taylor had some good at-bats. Those are a couple guys they really rely on a lot against left-handed pitching, so I think they'll be back and really key guys. Kemp had a nice at-bat there with the home run. So I think, to me, the way Dave Roberts gets his team tuned up for game two is by doing a lot of the same things he did in game one. I don't think it was a team or a case of the Dodgers being underprepared or overwhelmed. I think they just got beat by a really good team playing at home. And I think one thing to watch in general, probably on both teams, but I think certainly from Boston's standpoint, is with Ryu. Ryu's coming off a tough outing. His last start in the NLCS was not all that good, whereas Price's last start in the ALCS was the start of his lifetime in the playoffs. I look for the Red Sox to be as aggressive in game two as they were at the beginning of game one. Mookie gets on base. All of a sudden, he's stealing. He's scoring early points on the board, so to speak. I think that mentality, especially against Ryu, who may be searching for his confidence a little bit after his start in game six of the NLCS, that's the right approach to take for Boston. So if you see those guys on base early, Betts and Benintendi, I look for action on the bases early in the game, and if the Red Sox score early, I think it's going to be hard to slow them down in game two.
We're talking to John Morosi, and if that happens and LA's got to go back to LA having to win 4 out of 5 against a team that won 108 games, that does not bode well for them, obviously. John, when you mentioned the Dodgers who had quality at-bats, then you have Manny Machado as well, who had a good game swinging the bat. He's had a really interesting postseason, needless to say, ranging from some of the incidents with the Brewers to him saying that he was not going to be, quote, Johnny Hustle. That's not my cup of tea. What was your reaction to those comments? Did that surprise you at all?
A little bit. I think, Jim, it's so interesting that, you know, baseball, from a media standpoint and from what the players say, is still very traditional. And so when you've got someone who speaks his mind and says things that don't fit into the normal canon of what you hear players say, it stands out. to me, Manny Machado has backed up his words. He has had big hits for the Dodgers all postseason. He drove in a big run last night. He may have been hoping for more, but I think still that sac fly was big, a big early hit for him. I always worry about players when they talk a lot and then have a hard time settling in and playing. And I think Manny's complete confidence in his own ability is not wavering right now. And I think that's the important thing. His ability to play defense, we saw him make a sparkling play early in the game last night at shortstop. To me, as many critics as there may be about what he says, ultimately he's going to get paid on what he has done. And as a free agent this wintertime, the fact is he has been the Dodgers' probably their best hitter consistently throughout the playoffs, and he's playing a very good shortstop. I think that there may be some clubs that are a little turned off, Jim, by him, but he's also a marketable star in a sport that needs them, I think, nationally. And he's someone that is intriguing, who is talented. I think he is, as much as there are maybe those that believe he is not properly, quote-unquote, respecting the game, he's playing well. He clearly wants his team to win. He is there to win the World Series. So I think overall, you probably, if you're a GM, you feel the way about Manny Machado today as you did 2 weeks ago. As a scout told me last week, Jim, this has been Manny Machado since day one in terms of running balls out, what he has said. There's not really a big difference. So for the people that are around the game whose job it is to evaluate players and people, this really has not surprised them all that much.
We're talking to John Morosi. Hey, John, in terms of David Price tonight, I mean, obviously this is a World Series start. It's a critical start for him. But him personally, how important is it for David Price to pitch the way he can at this big stage? And how do you think he will show up tonight?
Well, Jim, I look for more of the same from his last start. Now, he talked really interestingly after the game about in the interview with TBS after the game was over, Lauren Shahadi in Game 5, about how having thrown and warmed up in the bullpen the previous night actually helped him get locked in Game 5, which is really, in a way, counterintuitive, but it makes more sense that he had a chance to get some of those nerves out the night before. I spoke with a scout yesterday, Kimball Crossley, who made the point that really it's a matter of the change-up feel being a really important dynamic there. So maybe the feel for the change-up was really important for him in Game 5. He had a chance to throw it and get it prepared in Game 4 in the bullpen. Again, not the way you typically do it, but it works for David. So I think now that was a great start, and the circumstances of it were perfect because his team was up. They were on the road. They almost had nothing to lose. And now the Red Sox have a 1-0 lead at home. The fans, I would assume, are now on his side following a very impressive start in the ALCS. So as much negativity as David has had to wade through during his time with the Red Sox, he has known and he has told me in numerous conversations over the last couple of years, if we win, everything takes care of itself. We just have to win. And they're winning right now. And it's amazing, Jim, how no matter what the sport is, however a fan base feels about a player, as soon as he comes up big in the playoffs, hey, he's our guy. He's my guy. I love that guy. And so that's kind of what's happening right now for David Price in Boston. I'm sure he probably smiles about it a little bit because I think, to his credit, he's always had a very strong sense of self-identity. He knows who he is. He's never really assigned too much of his personal value and how much he is getting cheered or booed by the fans. So I'm sure he's probably smiling at this a little bit, but I think in general the reality is he is pitching very well. That was a breakthrough moment for him, I believe, in the ALCS, and I expect another strong start from David Price at Fenway tonight.
John Morosi joining us. John, one last thought. Outside the World Series, I really want your thoughts on this. The Angels announced that Brad Ausmus is going to be their new manager. Personally, I love that choice. What can you tell us about the evaluation process and the interview process for that job? How did that go, and why did they pick him?
Well, this is really interesting, Jim, and I'm glad you asked about it because I think it is emblematic of the process teams are taking now. A couple things. They want managers who are extensions of the front office or who are at least fluent in the language of the front office, analytical, evaluation, very process-oriented. You hear a lot about that. And in fact, in Billy Epler's statement announcing Ausmus's hire, he used the word probabilistic, which I had to look up, and I don't often see in press releases about baseball, but that's just how the Angels are operating right now. And of course, Ausmus served last year as a special assistant to Billy Epler in the front office, so he's already well-versed in the organization. But also importantly, the Angels gave every one of their candidates a 2-hour written test. Brad Ausmus has a degree in government from Dartmouth College. He's a very smart man. And so it does not surprise me that Brad would have done well on a written test. And part of that is the way that analytical information is shared from front offices. This was not, to me, a matter of cherry-picking the process to make sure that they picked Ausmus. It's rather a manifestation of the way that teams operate now. You look at analytical information over a period of time. You evaluate it. You make your in-game decisions based on that analytical information, your lineup decisions, and it's done more over a period of hours than it is a couple minutes in a question in one interview about where you're going to bat Anderson Simmons, for example. So very interesting to me. I think certainly Brad was well-suited to do the job, and we're seeing a time now, Jim, where the game is moving away from long-standing, experienced minor league managers and major league coaches and moving towards maybe the college-educated and front office fluent candidates there. And Brad Ausmus, of course, is one of those examples.
Silk, is that you?
It's me, brah.
What's up, brah?
Matt in Poland Springs is exactly right. I would much rather sit in a stadium soaked in beer and urine and chowder than beautiful Chavez Ravine with a view of the downtown skyline. Now, first, I want to address this punk slot receiver, Julian Edelman, showing his true colors. Last time I paid any attention to him, he was getting put on blast by some Instagram skank because that, you know, slept with him after the Super Bowl. It's so obvious, dude. Of course he's a no-cal. He's a PED guy, just like Barry Bonds, bruh. True colors coming through. Edelman, good luck, bruh. Now, let's talk a little Dodger baseball. We're seeing the fruits of our general managers, Andrew Friedman, Farhan Zaidi, the Evil Eight, Yale Analytics Club, watching Cody Bellinger swing out of his ass. It's so ironic that our manager, who's responsible for one of the most iconic plays in baseball history as a pinch runner, I dare anyone to pull up the numbers on how many times the Dodgers lifted a player for a pinch runner this season, and you'll never see it in the playoffs. And Baez, people don't understand, Alex Cora is allowed to make his own decisions. Dave Roberts is running off a playbook from upstairs. I'm sure he's got a little leeway, but not much. You pull Baez, who's smoking fools at 96, just for the matchup. Everyone knew Alex Wood should have been left off this roster. It's crazy. Watching the Red Sox hit behind a runner on first, and taking a bag. Listen, Puig's going to make a mistake here or there, but these analytics may or may not play out over a 163-game season, but in a seven-game series, I don't think it's going to work out. And I'm not I respect the Red Sox. They got a great team. They got a ton of weapons. But Dave Roberts needs to be let loose. We need to pinch run. Cody Bellinger golf swinging. It's not doing us any good, bro. All right, man, it's going to be crazy. I'm actually watching the game at O'Connell's in Fountain Valley today with a buddy who's a Red Sox fan, bro. So come on down and meet us for the game. Okay, Avi, let's do this. Come on.
Brah.
Come on.
Come on.
Brah.
Come on. Come on, brah.
You can't even tell if that's live or not. Nice job, Silk. In fact, when I mean nice job, that was your best call in a long time. Liz in Falls City. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hey, Jim. The reason I'm calling is indeed about this recent crime wave going on with the XR4TI. First, Hawk gets busted for not having tags on his car, and now we have a Ross lookalike wanted by the UK police for theft. First, does this Ross look haggard and guilty from catching a red eye from London to LA overnight? And when the cops break down the doors after the show, can you scope it for us, for all of us to see? And what's next? Alvy getting pinched for bootlegging baby formula at the park, Keith stalking Eldrick at the PGA Tour. Soon these guys will be linked together wearing silver bracelets next to each other, banging out license plates in the clink. Anyway, Jim, war Scotty Farrell going on the Woods Goats next Friday, and war Dana White setting up an MMA night featuring Rondo and CP3 as the main event, because I'd love to see the Joaquin emails for that one. Take care, Jim. I'm out.
Bye, Liz.
Good night now!